Our second case this morning is 2020-338, the State of Ohio versus Samuel Glenn. For the appellant is Mr. Communell.
Good morning, Chief Justice and honorable members of this court. I would like to, can everybody hear me? I'm sorry.
Yes, we can.
Thank you. I apologize. I didn't realize whether I was muted or not. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal if possible. Again, my name is Tony Communell, on behalf of appellant Samuel Glenn, a criminal defendant before the Montgomery County Court of Common Pleas. To begin with, I'd like to address what I think was the initial error of our Court of Appeals, the Second District, in failure to examine the nature of the trial court's order. And by that, I mean, as I'm sure you're well aware, the order itself directs trial counsel to create summaries of conversations that trial counsel had with potential witnesses in the case to provide to the State of Ohio. And those conversations would have occurred during the course of investigation or otherwise interviews in preparation for trial.
Counsel, are these witnesses that you identified, are they alibi witnesses?
Specifically, the written order was for alibi witnesses, yes.
Okay, so do you intend to file a notice of alibi pursuant to Criminal Rule 12 in this case?
Yeah, interesting. There are two notices of alibis that were filed. The witnesses themselves, the record shows, were disclosed well before this issue came up. The trial was continued at one point to allow the government to investigate some of the names, but the names had already been disclosed. You'll see, I believe, in one of the responsive pleadings during the paper argument before the trial court that the defendant didn't claim to be at a different place. He claimed that the alleged victim wasn't there and there were witnesses that were there. After discussion, and this is a part of the transcript record, it was decided that the better course of action was to file a notice of alibi. So that was done.
And did you, in the notice of alibi, provide some degree of specificity as to what these witnesses would testify to? Just that the victim was not there at the time she claimed she was?
Yeah, that information was made clear. Whether it's in the notice of alibi or not, I'm not sure, but it's certainly in the record of the court that there was no claim. In fact, to be clear, because they needed to know where it was that the alibi witnesses claimed to be, that it was at the location of the alleged event.
So your defense is basically this accusation by the state did not happen because we have witnesses to support that the victim's version of events did not occur.
That's correct.
Okay, so isn't it your requirement under Criminal Rule 16 to just identify who those witnesses and tell them what they're going to say that's what they're going to say?
That's correct. And that was done twice, actually.
So what is the specific part of the order that they're requiring you to have these summaries of your investigation that you oppose?
Yes, Your Honor. In terms of the creation of the summaries, initially the trial court ordered the creation of all summaries. You'll see in the earlier pleadings and arguments about the discovery issue that there were a number of state's witnesses that would only talk to defense counsel. And this created a problem for the state. The state wanted to know, well, what did they say? And you'll also see reflected in the motion to compel the fact that defense counsel did share information. I think as any trial counsel would, to say, hey, you know, they may not say what you think they're going to say, go talk to them. Well, some of those people would not talk to them, and some of the alibi defenses wouldn't talk to them. Ultimately, when the decision came out, and the transcript of proceedings of the initial order of the court is within the record and briefed, but ultimately it was changed only to identify witnesses, but then consequences were put in place that witnesses could not be called if these summaries weren't created. So the creation of summaries as the order of the trial court and the failure of the Court of Appeals to analyze what that meant relative to a witness statement someone may have, or a videotape of the floor of a hospital or whatnot, and the various items that have been addressed by the court. The uniqueness of that led to, I think, the mistake of the Court of Appeals that what this was a reciprocal discovery issue. It was not. The case of the seminal case of Hickman versus Taylor dealt with exactly this issue. It was civil, but an attorney was asked to create summaries of people that he had talked to, witnesses he had talked to. And in that case, the court in that case said specifically that this is not a discovery issue. This does not fall within the parameters of a discovery request. Specifically that the subject matter of whether it was privileged or not privileged was irrelevant. Whether it was relevant or not was irrelevant, because nothing in disclosure rules would require an attorney to recreate conversations based upon his recall or notes or whatever he had. That would be an unjust interference with the judicial process. In fact, the Hickman case says there's no good reason for that, but there are tremendous reasons that violate public policy as why we wouldn't require that sort of intervention. So in first saying that, I think the mistake in the Court of Appeals in not examining the nature of the order, that it was to create summaries, led to this idea that then they had to pigeonhole it into, well, what sort of privilege was it? Now, in that case, the Court of Appeals decided, well, it was it dealt with a work product privilege. And of course, the court.
Counsel, what harm is there that could not be addressed on appeal at the conclusion of the trial should your client not prevail?
In terms of specifically, I would respond in a couple of ways. First, not only the public policy violations that are talked about in this court's own discussion in the majority opinion in Burnham versus Cleveland Clinic, that there can be disclosure orders that implicate interests well beyond, and that the extrajudicial harm that's done can't adequately be addressed. This sort of an order that an attorney go into their mental impressions, their recall, their memory, whatever, to assist or aid the other side, the various public policy reasons, I could list them from Hickman, but they're all pretty self-evident. Now,
is that what the trial court did in this case? Did they require some degree of specificity? All you would have to do is just say, these witnesses will testify that the victim wasn't there at the time she claimed the act occurred.
That was already done. That's already part of the record. What the trial court ordered was the creation of specific summaries as to the nature of the discussions defense counsel had with witnesses. And again, the written order does tailor it to only alibi witnesses.
Counsel, couldn't we deal with that on appeal later if counsel for Mr. Glenn just said, we're not going to do it? He goes on trial, he wins, case goes away, he loses. An appellate point would be that you were ordered to do this and you didn't do it, right? And that you couldn't put on these alibi witnesses. Couldn't we take care of that on appeal?
No, I don't believe so. And the reason that is because the idea that, first of all matters can be handled on appeal. Whether or not something falls within an interlocutory appeal is based upon different factors than just whether it can be addressed. Addressing this on appeal, first of all, is a guaranteed appeal. The trial court order provides for no choice but an issue of whether or not the attorney either does not meet his obligation to zealously represent his client by excluding material witnesses, or violates the principles set forth in Hickman and then Nobles, which later made it out.
In Hickman, there was no intermediate appeal, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't
there was that. There was no interlocutory appeal in Hickman. In Hickman, what the attorney did was refuse to disclose, was held in contempt. There was no right to immediately appeal that order.
There was none, but there is implicated in the decision that there should be. And that, you know, it's very hard to find, or at least it was for me, cases which were similar on point. The most recent
isn't that because courts generally don't allow interlocutory appeals of these types of things?
Generally, based upon, in large part, judicial economy. If you're dealing with a trial court decision that violates public policy pretty much across the board and guarantees an appeal, that's certainly not serving judicial economy. In the New Jersey versus Tier case, which is cited, which was the same thing.
It certainly doesn't guarantee that there'll be an appeal at the end. I mean, you don't know how the case is going to come out.
Certainly no. If the defendant wins the case, yes, of course. But in an effort to protect the defendant throughout, which I think goes into the second part of the argument, which was why it should be treated differently. My first point is that I don't think it matters whether it's work privilege or not work privilege, because it's outside of the scope of the discoverable order. If it's outside of the scope of the discoverable order with the consequences that are set forth in the cases prior, then clearly it should fall under 2505 in terms of being immediately addressed. However, even if it were to be, it's certainly not a finding, as the Court of Appeals found, that it is a work product violation. And the reason for that is it's self-evident. The order is for the creation, at best, the creation of work product. It's actually telling the attorney, you create the work product from the work you've done to assist the other side in preparation of their case. This being a criminal case, to assist in the prosecution of the trial court or the trial attorney's own client, which itself, I think, is against public policy.
What if the attorney had simply said, these witnesses are going to testify that they were with the defendant at a party that night, and that was it. No clients, no attorney, mental impressions, work, all those things we talk about as work products.
That's
the judge. The judge says that's sufficient. It's reviewed at the end of the case. What would be wrong with that? I mean, why not see what happens?
If you look at the two motions to compel filed by the state, they themselves recognize that in fact was done. Discussions were had in which the trial counsel said, here's what these people are going to say. That wasn't sufficient for the state. They wanted to know specifically. They wanted to know specific summaries. So in their own argument, they admit that it's been said. Now, one of the things is the government threatens to call the defense counsel as a witness if this isn't provided. I guess under the assumption that because the defense counsel said, here's what I think they're going to testify to, they've now become witnesses. Well, that is just simply a violation of our principles of negotiation. If we don't share information about cases or what our expectations are, or we feel that, hey, we might be witnesses in a case if we say, I think this witness is going to say that, then that would certainly have its own chilling effect. I think the order for the creation is the problem, not the order for the disclosure. If there were witness statements, if the record reflected someone had given a written statement or a recorded statement or anything like that, I think actually the law is fairly clear that those are part of reciprocal discovery. It is not part of...
Are you focusing only on the creation of documents, or also under Criminal Rule 16J, which the state didn't mention in its briefing, material that's subject to the work product protection? Is it one or both?
Well, if I understand the question correctly, it is in fact both, because while the argument below at the Court of Appeals was, shouldn't be pigeonholed into that specific work product argument, which leads, of course, to an entire discussion about the difference between work product and client privilege and how they might be treated differently on an interlocutory appeal, in reliance on Hickman, since this is not within a discovery realm and shouldn't have been ordered in the first place. However, obviously, we have to have a fallback position that even if they were within that line, they are still work product protected from disclosure. Now, I think more specifically to answer your question would be to say that the if the attorney possessed a written statement made by a client, not a client, I'm sorry, but a witness, then the work product privilege is waived under the case law, under the rules. But this order does not ask for that. This order asks for the creation, and therefore 16J does prohibit that. So it's kind of the government's end around the rules to say, okay, well, you don't have it, go ahead and create it. I don't know if that answers specifically.
That helps, thank you.
All right, counsel, you've used your time. Thank you very much. Mr. French.
Good morning, Your Honor. Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. I don't want to oversimplify matters, but it is the state's position that appellant is going into a scope of this appeal that is far beyond what is before this court. The Second District did not consider the merits of the trial court's discovery order because the Second District found that the order was not a final appeal order under 2505.02b.4b. Specifically, the Court of Appeals found that they were not convinced that the appellant would not have a reasonable and effective remedy on direct appeal following judgment. And so far this morning and in his brief, I have yet to hear appellant offer a reason why that portion of the Second District's opinion was in error.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Your counsel on the other side claims that they've already told you what these witnesses are going to say. Is that true?
I would submit that is not true. If that were true, I don't believe there would have been any need to file the motion to compel, and there would be no need for the trial court to have put on this order. What appellant did was file a notice of alibi, which said in essence that on the date and during the times relevant to this case, the defendant was at one of three different addresses and was with, at various times, one of nine different people. 2 months later, he amended the alibi, the same three locations, but added a 10th person. A month after that, he amended the notice of alibi to change one of the addresses and to keep one of the 10 and keep the original 10 people. So at the end of the day, what the prosecution knew is that the defendant's alibi was he was at one of three different places and was with one or more of 10 different people.
Okay, does that what he told you, does that contradict what your alleged victim says, or would that directly contradict?
Yes, that would contradict what the victim said, which
okay,
is
okay. So you have investigators, you have the ability to go out and question these people, right?
They all refused to speak to anyone associated with the prosecution. And during various off the record conversations, during emails, there were these sort of hints and suggestions that these witnesses were going to say things that were different or that would tank the case or would be inconsistent with the state's theory. So what the state was looking for was simply some information about what specifically these alibi witnesses were alleging. Were they alleging that they were with the defendant at the first address he gave? Were they alleging he was later at the second address, but one of these other people were there? All the trial court was asking appellant to do was to provide some additional detail, nothing elaborate, nothing that went into counsel's theory of the case or its mental and his mental impressions, just something as simple as witness A would testify that he was with the defendant at this address and the victim was not present.
Something so you're just looking for a higher that. Level of specificity as to what these witnesses are going to say. You don't anticipate using counsel's statements to cross-examine at trial these witnesses as if they were affidavits or
I suppose the only effect on cross-examination might be if what is said in explanation as to witness A would testify he was with the defendant at this address, if that witness testified inconsistent with that, perhaps the prosecution would attempt to cross-examine with possible prior inconsistent statements. But beyond that, no, it certainly would not be an affidavit. It would be nothing sworn under oath. It would not be the witness's own testimony. It was an attempt by the trial court to provide more of a level playing field the spirit of the rules regarding alibis.
Okay. Now, so you're just looking for a higher level of specificity as to what defendant's alibi witnesses will testify to at trial.
That's all that the trial court had ordered.
And that's it?
That's it, yes.
You're not looking for counsel's written impressions or their assessment of their credibility or anything like that?
No, nothing at all.
Counsel, your colleague on the other side mentioned that some people weren't even talked to by investigators from the government. Is that correct?
I do not know if that is correct or not. I do not know.
Well, so these witnesses technically were not unavailable. They just wouldn't talk to you. The ones at least that were talked to.
That is my understanding. Yes.
Mr. French, what's the difference in terms of the 2505.02 analysis on final appealable order? Discuss for me the difference between attorney-client privilege and attorney work product.
Well, the most obvious would be anything that is protected by the attorney-client privilege would be any communications between the attorney and the client, him or herself, in this case.
I guess what I'm getting at is framed in terms of why it would be critical to get that issue resolved before a final disposition of the matter. Compare the two.
Well, the attorney-client privilege is a recognized privilege at common law that has been held in a much higher regard and is much less subject to invasion. And once the attorney-client privilege has been breached, there's essentially the bell has been rung and there's no going back. Once that privilege has been breached, there's no reasonable mechanism to cure or hide the breach. The attorney work product has never been held by this court to the level of protection that the attorney-client privilege has been held to. This court held in, I believe it's Burnham, that when the work product exception is alleged, more than just a claim that it's privileged or protected is needed before that theory or that process is deemed so violated that an interlocutory appeal would be necessary. That is why when applying 250504, the Court of Appeals found that the appellant had not offered really any explanation as to why this error, if the trial court's order is error at all, could not be remedied effectively after a final judgment. An appellant still has not offered a valid explanation as to why they could not adequately remedy any error that may have occurred in the trial court's order, why that remedy could not be effective post-judgment, which
so counsel, presumably the witnesses would have been precluded from testifying. Is that what you think would have happened had this gone forward?
According to the trial court's order, if counsel had not provided the summary of anticipated testimony, the trial court had indicated its intention to exclude those witnesses. Yes.
Okay, so that's appealable, right? I mean, if the defendant loses, that's been known to be appealed time and time again about inappropriate exclusion of witnesses. Maybe, yes. I mean, not necessarily based on this basis, but for a variety of reasons.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. Also, the state withdrew its request at some point for this information with the trial court, correct?
Yes, it's my understanding that the state filed a motion to withdraw its request after appellant had perfected his appeal to this court.
Okay, was that an attempt to not come to see us, or was that where you genuinely felt you didn't need that information anymore?
I think it was an attempt to get the case moving forward at the trial court level and to eliminate any further delay. This case involved a teenage girl who was allegedly sexually assaulted by the defendant. Those types of cases are difficult enough to prosecute without prolonged delay. And I believe the prosecutor's hope was that it could move this case along sooner rather than later. So yes, I believe the intention was to perhaps moot the appeal or make this appeal unnecessary.
Counsel, is this defendant being held in pretrial detention?
No, I don't believe he is, no.
Okay. But if these alibi witnesses are telling the truth, the sooner that information gets into your hands and you can assess it, it's exculpatory information, potentially, that yes. would have you decide to potentially, if it refutes what the alleged victim is saying, dismiss the case, correct?
That could very well happen, yes. Yes.
Counsel, if that's true, then your colleague's statement that some people haven't even been spoken to kind of undercuts that argument, does it not? That you haven't even spoken to all the people on his list?
If that statement is true, yes. I don't know that that statement is true. I don't know who all the prosecutor or the police or the investigator have attempted to speak to. It is my understanding that while there are 10 names listed in the alibi, somehow the prosecutor had been able to narrow it down to perhaps one specific witness, which they believe would be the key alibi witness. And I do know for a fact that that one particular witness has refused to speak to the prosecutor. To the extent that other witnesses have been attempted to be contacted or not contacted, I cannot speak to that.
Thank you.
But ultimately, I would submit that regardless of how proper the trial court's order may or may not be, regardless of how successful appellant may or may not ultimately be on appeal in challenging the trial court's order. Ultimately, this case came before this court because the second district chose not to consider the merits of the order. and concluded that this was not a final appealable order because the defendant appellant had not satisfied his obligation of showing that he would lack a meaningful and effective remedy post-judgment. And I would submit that that is still the case today. And for that reason, unless the court has any further questions for me, I would stand on the merits of my brief on any other issues and concern and ask that this court affirm the Second District's opinion below.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Communell, I believe you have used your time. You may take a minute. You'll have to turn your mic on.
I apologize. First, on some questions that were asked about materials off the record, specifically whether or not the state knew about where the witnesses were or what they'd say or whatnot, those don't appear in the record. However, regardless of the answer, what they knew, it's alluded to in their motions to compel that they had this information. More importantly, though, the order of the trial court does not order the defendant to say where these witnesses were or when. It orders the defendant's counsel to provide written summaries of statements made to defense counsel or a defense investigator by witnesses that the defense intends to call the trial. It's much more blanket than the sort of very specific laser focus of that one issue, which may or may not have been a problem. Secondly, I think, again, in looking at Hickman, the amount of damage to literally the legal system, the way we do things adversarially, in and of itself causes harm, extrajudicial harm, well beyond the particular defendant. Anything can be appealed. Anything can be rectified on appeal.
But counsel, let me ask you this.
Yes.
You've uncovered information from witnesses you've investigated that, if true, directly refutes what the alleged victim says in this case, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so that's exculpatory information. Don't you have a reciprocal duty, just like the state would, if they found information that refutes their case or casts doubt upon their case, to get that into the hands of the state so they can assess it? And if it's correct, they can dismiss the case. Doesn't that behoove your client?
First, I don't know that there's a rule that the defense has to disclose exculpatory evidence. Secondly, of course, when the state's witnesses won't talk to them, when the defense witnesses have information that's exculpatory, of course that information is shared.
Well, you have to have a good faith belief. You have to have a good faith belief that these alleged alibi witnesses are telling the truth. You can't just put them up there. You have an ethical obligation. You can't suborn perjury, right?
Absolutely. And the information that was shared with the state's own witnesses to defense counsel, along with the others, was shared as much as it could be in all relevant parts to try to settle the case.
Settle the case? Why would the case be settled? If your client's innocent, why would the case be settled?
Why would the criminal case might reach a settlement? Let's say, for example, we're talking about an adult. He said teenager. This is an 18-year-old girl. Is it conceivable that, you know, a misdemeanor, non-affecting, non-reporting charge might have been resolved to save the money, expense, and risk of trial? Of course it would. Of course it would. So every effort was made to settle.
Mr. Cromwell, just to help me, you've talked about the damage to the legal system, but what is it about this situation that would not afford your client a meaningful or effective remedy following an appeal?
The appeal
of a final judgment.
Within the statutory framework of whether or not there was a meaningful appeal, the Court of Appeals first mistakenly found that the privilege was singular. I argue that the privilege is irrelevant under Hickman, but it's certainly not singular to ask an attorney to use his collective memory, impressions of the case, to try to recreate statements made. Now, the prosecution in this matter, the indictment indicates, was delayed for almost 2 years. So to go back and say, okay, the defense counsel has to segregate that which is, and this is suggested in the Court of Appeals, that which may be inculpatory, that which may have come from his client's own statements. We all know that clients say this person will tell you this, and maybe you go and you talk to the person. So that was a secondary argument that was made, that it is at best a hybrid. It's certainly not work product because it hasn't even been created, but once created, it would be a hybrid privilege.
But how does it damage your client's interest now? I mean, why is it not sufficient that you could deal with this when a trial was had and a final judgment? Why couldn't you deal with all of this on the appeal of a final judgment?
It could be, but the damage would be done. I mean, anything could be dealt with on an appeal, whether it falls within something that justifies an interlocutory appeal, such as in the New Jersey versus Tier case, or whether it doesn't, anything can be appealed. What I'm saying is that the damage here is so severe, not just the defendant. By the way, going through multiple trials is damaging to him. And it's very clear, and I agree with counsel for the state, that the actual nature of the trial court's decision isn't really at issue here. But I would also say that nobody could seriously argue that it was a correct order one way or the other. It was just not. So the chances of multiple trials in the case, of potential future confinement while this is resolved, those are all real direct impacts on him.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, gentlemen. We will take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, we call a recess, please.
Thank you, Justice.
The court will now adjourn for a brief recess.